It is the Carellcast. I am Carell Charles Raymond Carell Boulay the second. Happy Tuesday to you all. So very glad you are joining me. I read this story with great interest because the West Coast is under attack. Forget Kim Jong-un or Kim Jong-il or whatever his name is. Forget the Kim. Forget little Kim. Okay, he is not. I know our president last week was over there talking all the war rumblings, but guess what? Lil Kim is not the problem. The West Coast is under attack. It is under siege. The entire West Coast, from Seattle, Washington, down to San Diego, California, and everything in between. Santa Cruz, San Francisco, the entire Bay Area, Portland, Oregon. The West Coast is under siege, and no one has a concrete plan of attack to save us from what is happening. Now, a lot of you who listen to my show on a regular basis, you know that Long Beach is experiencing an enormous homeless crisis. Okay? We just are. It is an absolute terrible situation. So it was with great interest that I read the cover of the LA Times last week when the story said, West Coast under siege. And it is. 11 cities. I bet you guys didn't know this. 11 cities. Okay? 11. 11 cities have declared a state of emergency. Okay? 11 cities have declared a state of emergency, meaning they are in a critical crisis situation. And their state of emergency is homelessness. Homelessness. It has now reached epidemic proportions. More people are homeless in the United States than are on opioids, I believe. I don't know that the numbers would back me up. I know that there are millions on opioids, but I contend that there are millions of homeless. They say there's not. I don't know what they even estimate the homeless population of the United States, not just our state. But let me type in 2017 homeless population United States and see if there's any kind of number. At the beginning of 2017, 62,000 men, women, and children slept in New York City homeless shelters each night. 62,000 in New York each night. So yes, then there are millions of homeless. If that's just one city, then we know there's hundreds of thousands, but probably millions of homeless in the United States. And what are we going to do? You know, what are we doing? What are we going to do? There's these, you know, a 2000 study estimated 3.5 million people were homeless. That's back in 2000. Jumped to 2017 with improved data. All right. And what you've got now is possibly up to 7 million homeless people. And there's all these myths about the homeless. Do you know 44% of homeless people are employed? 44%. Of homeless people are employed. Okay? They are employed. An overwhelming majority of homeless are male. Are male. In 2008, the most common demographic of all sheltered homeless people were they were male, they were members of minority groups, they were older than 31 years old, and they were alone. More than 40% of sheltered homeless people have a disability. More than 40%. At the same time, sizable segments of the sheltered homeless population are white, non-Hispanic, 38%, children, 20%. That means there are hundreds of thousands of homeless children every single night in America. 68% of the over 2 million sheltered homeless every night are persons with families. Wow. 66% of the sheltered homeless are in cities. Only 32% in rural areas. Homeless people live in cities. Now, they talk about the causes in this article about the West Coast being under siege. Where'd you go, Amber? I saw you. They talk about, you know, why? Why are 44% of the people employed that are homeless and yet homeless? And when they talked about this crisis in this article, the West Coast under siege, they talked about how hard it is to solve the problem. There is a failure of urban housing projects that provide safe and secure and affordable housing to the poor. Nobody wants them in their neighborhood. Who wants the projects? And once we build them, we forget about them. We let them fall into decay and disarray. We let crime run rampant. There is no such thing in mass, meaning a lot, of safe, secure, affordable housing for the poor. And that's the first issue to address homelessness. If 44% of the homeless people are working, okay, 44%, that means 44% can afford some sort of housing. Maybe not the rents that they're charging. You know, a USA Today headline just came across this week about the rental market and that we're not buying houses now, we're all renting. And what does that mean to the homeowning market? You know, what does it mean if everybody's a renter? And the rents are skyrocketing. Cities are trying to enact rent control because landlords are making people homeless. Look, in my city, there are enough empty houses from banks. Banks owned empty houses in my city to house the 2,000 homeless that they say there are. There is enough empty housing in every city in America to house the people that are homeless. We won't. We don't want to put them in our neighborhoods. And I don't blame you. I want to move because of the homeless. I certainly do. All right, that's the first thing. So the failure of urban housing projects. Second, the deinstitutionalization movement of the 50s onward of the mental health system. And yes, everyone talks about Reagan. But remember, the people that Reagan put out on the streets are dead. And they addressed this in that story about the West Coast under siege and how 11 cities, including yours probably, my city, has declared a state of emergency. Santa Cruz, San Diego, Portland, Seattle, they have declared states of emergency over homeless. Redevelopment and gentrification. This is widespread. You know, widespread. They are demolishing low-income neighborhoods. They're tearing them down. And they are making way for projects that generate higher property taxes and other revenue. But that creates a shortage of housing for low-income working families, the elderly, poor, and the disabled. And we know by the numbers, that's who's ending up homeless. The elderly, poor, the disabled, and poor working families. The failure of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs to provide effective mental health care and meaningful job training has caused a spike in homeless veterans, particularly from the Vietnam War. So we're still screwing them. Nearly half, okay, nearly half of foster children in the United States become homeless when they are released from foster care at the age of 18. At the age of 18, can you imagine? We kick these kids out of foster care at the age of 18 with little or no tools to go out into the world, and half of all foster children, half become homeless. Half. Can you believe that? Natural disasters that destroy homes, hurricanes, floods, earthquakes, we've had a plethora of them. Places of employment are often destroyed too. In Houston, in Florida, in Mexico City, in Puerto Rico, we're having an enormous homeless crisis. Their homes were destroyed. They can't afford to rebuild them. The landlords aren't going to rebuild them. Where are they supposed to go? You're a tenant in low-income housing. The low-income housing has been destroyed. There's no more in your city. Where do you go? Where do you go? According to the Institute for Housing, in 2016, the U.S. government focused 42% of its efforts more on foreign countries rather than homelessness in the United States. So 42% more resources are given to helping people in other countries than helping American homeless. Adults and children who flee domestic violence make up at least 20% of the homeless. As you're staring at these homeless people, teenagers who flee or are thrown out by parents who disapprove of their child's sexual orientation or gender, there is a disproportionately high number of homeless youth. Between 20 to 40% of those identify as gay. Wow. Wow. And the overly complex building codes of the West Coast make it difficult for people to build. So huts, cars, tents, they're illegal. They're classified as substandard. They're removed, even though the occupant may own the land. If the landowner cannot live on the land cheaply, they sell the land and they become homeless. You might own a piece of land, but you can't build a thing up to code, so they don't let you sleep in a tent on it. And on the West Coast, in the last 10 years, foreclosures account for 10% of the homeless population. 10% of the people on the streets are there because they were evicted from a rental property or foreclosed upon. 10%. So the homeless population is not who we think it is. We think it's a bunch of drug addict crazies. It's not. 44% of them are working. So what do we do about it? What do we do with 11 cities on the West Coast under siege? The sad part is, until the government, the federal government, makes a Department of Homelessness, and they can call it whatever they want. The Department of Housing can handle it, whatever they want to call it. Until we now have police, in some areas they are having police that deal with the homeless specifically, we have to have a specific homeless strategy, and we're not developing it. We have to have police that deal with them just on the road. Do you know here in Los Angeles, I'm not making this up, in LA, the district attorney is setting up a special legal task force and court system in LA. They're putting aside courts to deal with all the sexual harassment coming out of Hollywood. They're actually assigning special prosecutors, judges, and courts to deal with it. So why can't we do the same for homelessness? Why can't we set up police, fire, paramedics, all of it to deal with the problem? And the answer is, we simply don't want to. When we come back, whose rights are more important, the homeowners or the homeless? That's a big issue that's happening right now. You know, it used to be we'd spend a minute telling you about someone else's product and then hope that you would buy it. And if you did, as advertisers, we would make revenues through our show. Well, that works a little bit nowadays, but not the same as it used to. So we now need you, the people, to help us raise money for our shows. It's a new way of doing things. It's a new year, and I need your help. Just $5 or $10 a month, depending on your budget, will keep the show alive. We're at about $700 a month right now. We really need that to be between $1,500 and $2,000 to even, you know, to even just keep it going, kids. So I know we can do it. Get everyone you can to subscribe. That way everything stays free. The app is free. The website, really, Carell, is free. All of that stays free because of your monthly donations of just $5 or $10 a month. Just go to Patreon, patreon.com/Carell, K-A-R-E-L, and give what you can to keep a progressive, gay-friendly voice on the air in this very crucial election year.
Hey, it's Carell. Not only can you watch me each and every week on Free Speech TV and at lifeandsegments.com, but you can stream me each and every day right here on the Progressive Voices Network, as well as my own dedicated app and all streaming services. Now, here's a little of what you're missing.
This is the Carellcast. I am Carell. My friends love me, but they do not respect my life choices. Yesterday was my birthday party, even though my birthday's left till tomorrow. And what did my best friends bring? Dickie's Barbecue. Yes, their rationing was, well, he might be a vegan, but nobody else is. So they wanted to feed everybody at my party. But they forgot to bring anything for me. You can eat the green beans and the coleslaw. No, coleslaw has mayonnaise, that's eggs and oil. The green beans are made with bacon. So they brought probably $250 worth of food to my birthday party, and I couldn't eat any of it. I couldn't eat a drop, not a bit. And that was kind of, I mean, it was nice. I was... You know, because I spent $120, thank you, Sue Yeager. on the party. For alcohol, I wasn't going to drink. And dips, I wasn't going to eat. I did get me some hummus, and I went to lunch at the Hip Pea and had falafel before my party. But that's the problem with making proper life choices now. Nobody does. You know, you want to get up and exercise. Let's go for a walk after dinner. Oh, no. In terms of food, you know, I could have made delicious vegan food, but they didn't want any. They're like, no, don't. I'm like, look, I can get some stuff, you know, and it'll be delicious, and you guys won't even know. It'll be lovely. No, that's okay. We'll bring barbecue. So they sat there and chowed down on, and they didn't even bring any chicken or turkey. They just brought beef and pork, lots of it, ribs and brisket and just everything, lots, like for 10. There were how many trays? 12 trays, 15 trays of stuff. It was pretty amusing. At the vegan's birthday party, there was nothing but meat. Kind of amusing. Oh, okay. We are walking the morning after another shooting in America. You know, on Life in Segments airing every Thursday on Free Speech TV now that you should be watching, I did a segment and I mentioned Las Vegas and I said the worst shooting, you know, in American history, except when you watch this, unfortunately, there'll probably have been another historic shooting. And sure enough, the shooting yesterday was the worst mass shooting in Texas history. It's the worst one in their history. So we keep having these historic shootings. And so you can't, as a news person anymore, say, you know, this is the worst, because every week now there's another worst. And that says more about our inaction. And you know what I mean? In most countries, they wouldn't have that happening because they would do something about it. But in our country, we're just not. So... that's amazing to me. Even more amazing than the guy that just walked past me angry at himself. He was like talking to himself and he was doing this, you know, that kind of thing with his lips, like he was angry with himself. That was kind of scary. Love our morning walk, don't we, Miss Ember? Oh, the things we see. We got to pick up the pace a little bit. I'm talking and that is slowing me down because I got to keep making my good life choices. I don't want to be out here walking this morning, but I put myself on a new schedule, and I must be done walking by 8:30, so it is 7:20 my time in the morning. I'm talking to you on my walk. I wasn't going to do shows this week. I'm supposed to be on vocal rest, so anything I give you is a plus, right? One segment, two segments.
Be sure to tune in each and every day.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, each Monday and Wednesday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday,
you can hear us 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear.
What do you do with the ideology of hate? Whether it's Nazis marching in Charlottesville, whether it's a terrorist marching in the name of ISIS, whether it's some guy full of hate in Las Vegas who we're not even sure why he hated so much. What can we do about it? What should we do about it? Hate sells. Hate, and particularly ethnic hate, racist hate, gets people moving, particularly when it's hatred of the other. So we got hate all over the place. And yet, there are ways to fight back. There is ways, I think, that we can successfully fight against terrorists, whether they be Islamic terrorists or white terrorists or mentally ill ones. And need to fight back. We need more aggressive progressives. Again, that's Mark Levine every Monday and Wednesday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
It is the Carellcast. I am Carell, Charles Raymond Carell Boulay II, coming to you live on video with live interactive chat every Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 11:30 in the mornings, and then coming to you each and every day, Monday through Friday, on your favorite streaming service, and of course, your favorite radio station. So there's audio Monday through Friday. There is video on the weekend. If you are a Patreon subscriber, you get the video and the live interaction. That's why you should join and support the show. So all of you, actually, should be watching the video. There should be no one that can't watch the video because you all should be supporting the show at reallycarell.com, and there's a donate button there, and I thank you for joining me. All right, We are talking about West Coast Under Siege, a story in the LA Times, a story in the San Francisco Chronicle, a story in the Seattle newspapers. About 11 cities on the West Coast have declared states of emergency. This is a major thing when they do that. In San Diego, they are power washing the streets with bleach because of the hepatitis A epidemic. Santa Cruz, people have died in New Mexico, have died in Santa Cruz, have died in San Diego. The homeless blight is the biggest problem facing the West Coast. I have all the numbers to back it up. And now the newspapers and television stations are starting to pay attention to this blight. So let me ask you, you're a homeowner or a renter or an employee. And every day you walk to work and you have to step over human feces or body fluids because that person chooses to live there. You're a homeowner. You open up your garage. There's feces behind it. Or there's a person on a mattress behind it. What do you do? A lot of homeowners and renters are getting fed up and they're getting attacked by do-gooders who say, well, what are these people supposed to do? Where are these people supposed to go? How are these people, you know, you shouldn't kick them off your property. You shouldn't be mean to them. You know, you should offer them things. You should give them food. We should build bathrooms for them. I have a question. When does my right as a landowner supersede their right to want to be a non-productive member of society? When does my right as a landowner come before my government's failure? It is not my fault my city is failing these homeless people. It is not my fault the federal government is failing these homeless people. So when does my right, when does it become your right to walk down Market Street in San Francisco and not be accosted by someone out of their crazy mind stinking? When does it become your right in Santa Cruz to go to the boardwalk, your right in Monterey to walk downtown? When does it become your right in Cleveland or New York or New Orleans? Hello, Eileen. When does it become your right to not see these things, to not have to deal with it every single day? According to many, it never does. You don't have a right to not be around the homeless. You don't have a right to not have their feces in the alley. According to the police, because they don't care, they won't come clean it up. They'll barely come and arrest the person. No one seems to care about your right to a germ-free, you know, environment. Well, you don't have a right. They have a right to be lying on the sidewalk. You know, you don't have a right to a clean bus stop. You should have to share that bus stop with the person that's got 12 bags and smells like urine. After all, they're a person too. Are they? When is it your right as a homeowner or a renter to say enough is enough? I've had enough of these people, and I'm going to do anything I can to get them out. Are you a bad person because of it? Are you a bad person if you say, look, I don't care where they go, they just can't be here anymore? Are you a bad person because of that? I say, no, you're not. You know what? I am as compassionate as the next person, but I'm sorry, they can't be in my neighborhood anymore. I'm going to call the cops every time I see them. I'm going to kick them out every time I can. I'm going to make them move. I'm going to drag their stuff away. I'll destroy it or throw some of their stuff into the trash if I have to. They don't have a right to infest my world. No, I don't have a right to not be disturbed. I don't have a right to live this, you know, wonderfully harmonious life. No one has that right. However, we also don't have the right, they don't have the right to completely disrupt your life. They just don't have that right. And I think part of the problem is accepting the homeless for who they are. While half of them don't want to be there and half of them are working and all of that, up to 30% of them have made the choice to be there. And we can't accept that. We can't say, how could anybody actually choose that? In fact, we have a problem accepting a lot in our country. We don't have a clear picture of who we are or where we're going. My next guest, she believes that the first step to happiness is radical acceptance of your fate. And you all know me. You know that I'm one to not really accept one's fate. So let's talk to Dr. Meal about her best-selling book and radical acceptance of who we are and where we're going. We'll talk to her next. Hey, it's Carell, and broadcasting has changed. It truly has. No more are there big corporate radio entities that are providing quality programming. Now, if you want quality programming, you got to go find it. And typically, it's going to be a podcast, which means you're going to have to support it. Whether it's me or someone else, you've got to support the artists that are entertaining you each and every day. That's why there's this great service called Patreon, Patreon.com. Patreon, Patreon.com/Carell. That's K-A-R-E-L. That's how you can find my Patreon. And all you do is become one of my patrons, because every artist needs a patron, or two, or three, or 500, or 1,000. For 25 cents a show, which is $5 a month, or 50 cents a show, which is $10 a month, you can keep progressive, liberal, gay-friendly programming on air, and pet-friendly, too. I mean, Ember's listening right now, and is Attila right out the door. Patreon, Patreon.com/Carell. Please give what you can. Keep me on the air. I'll appreciate it, and so will you.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, each Monday and Wednesday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday,
you can hear us 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear.
The White House was in full panic mode. I mean, you could almost hear the screaming where I live, just across the river. People running around, Donald Trump brooding at the television set, shouting. I don't know whether he broke the set or not. He may have by throwing things at it. But all the petulant hatred you would expect from people who are getting nervous they're going to get caught. The first two on Mueller's list, of course, are Paul Manafort and his assistant, Mr. Gates. Manafort, we've long known, has no moral compass whatsoever. This is a guy who has made a career out of helping dictators brutalize their populations. Someone has to profit from that, right? And Paul Manafort said, it's going to be me. If we're going to have a brutal dictator and he's going to massacre hundreds of thousands of citizens, if he's going to stomp out free speech and make sure to put his brutal foot of oppression on an entire country, I want to profit from it. And, you know, that's, I think, typical of a certain kind of lobbyist. Tends to be Republican, though not always. There's a few Democrats there. But they're people who have no moral compass whatsoever. People who really don't give a damn what they do as long as they profit from it. And it's interesting to me because there used to be some Republicans, still are a few, John McCain, maybe one of them, or Jeff Flake, who actually give a damn about the morality of the people that they help. Paul Manafort really didn't care at all. And one of the really nice things about this indictment is we're going to learn in detail exactly what Manafort was doing 10 years ago. Now, I was on the air 10 years ago, and I remember what was happening in Ukraine, and I even talked about it on the air because Ukraine had a really important election. They had an election between a legitimate Ukrainian democratic leader and a Putin puppet. I think Putin could give a lot of credit to Paul Manafort for managing to make up lies that turned people against, one against another. And he's very, very good at that. I suspect that's why he got hired by Donald Trump. But he made at least $75 million, the indictment says, probably a good bit more, laundered $18 million, and basically didn't pay taxes on them. So, you know, one of the things about helping evil people is it doesn't just lead to a bunch of dead bodies. You got to pay your taxes on it. And Paul Manafort didn't do that and also lied about being a foreign agent. So that's the heart of the case they have against him, and it's pretty severe stuff. Now, Trump famously, proudly tweeted, this all happened before he came to work for me. And, well, that part is true. But here's the problem. It's serious stuff. It's stuff that Paul Manafort really has no defense to. And so the only way he's going to get these charges, 12 separate charges, lightened on him, because he can go to jail for, I think between him and Gates, it's 80 years combined, is to sing like a canary, and tell us what he did with Donald Trump. And we know that Paul Manafort kept his ties with the Russians after this event. And we also know that he managed to bring some of the same ethnic hatred to the United States that he did so well in Ukraine and in Russia. And so when we have these lies spread across the internet, we still have people attacking Hillary Clinton, including a few on the left, believing some of these vicious lies that Paul Manafort and his Russian minders made up. Now we're going to have to find out exactly what happened. Again, that's Mark Levine every Monday and Wednesday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Y'all, I cannot wait to accept my Emmy so I can thank each and every one of you for making Carell's Life and Segments the success that it is. We have to be just bound for Emmy or Pulitzer or somebody because we are creating some TV that is shaking things up. Now, if you don't believe me, you've got to tune in. For instance, we did a segment called No Pay Copay. Did you know that your pharmacist doesn't get any money from your insurance company? And sometimes your pharmacist might actually have to pay the drug company in order to fill your prescription. That's what we're talking about on Carell Life and Segments. We're talking about your life. We're talking about the parts of it that you never see because I dare to ask those questions. I go behind the scenes. You know me. I am not afraid to talk to anybody, whether it's a homeless person in the park, which we went and talked about, the social safety net, or whether it's sitting around and talking about cannabis in Cannabis Corner with some newsmakers as we sit and vaporize. That's right. I get high on air. It's Carell Life and Segments. All bets are off because it's your life reflected on my show. Tune in each and every week, Saturday nights at 7 o'clock Pacific on Free Speech TV or at my website, Really Carell. It is the Carellcast. I am Carell, Charles Raymond Carell Boulé. So very glad you are joining me. Happy Tuesday. All right. Do you know who you are? Do you accept who you are, really? And once you do, can you deal with that? Radical acceptance is an interesting concept. And there was an author pitched to me. And I thought, wait a minute, accept your own fate? You know, just accept the lot that's been given to you? I've got to talk to this person. And so I did. And once I had the conversation with this person, I'll tell you, I kind of like the idea of radical acceptance. Her name is Dr. Meal, and let's check in with her.
All righty. One of the things I like to do is mix up a conversation. And so when I got the pitch for this next guest, I thought, wait a minute, the title or the theme of this goes against everything in my life that I refuse to accept my fate. I will fight and rally against it. So when I saw that the topic was that maybe the key to happiness is actually accepting your fate, I said, I have got to talk to Dr. Deborah Meal. And luckily, she has made herself available to us for that very thing. And she is here with us now. Hello, doctor, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, now I got to talk about this because I have made a lifetime and a career out of not accepting, quote unquote, my fate. And so in your book, Joyful Transformation, 22 Keys to Reclaiming Your Authenticity, you talk about accepting your fate as being one of your keys to happiness. Explain that to me.
Well, it's not so much your fate as it is the circumstance in the moment. So what happens is that when we have a particular circumstance in the moment and we don't like it, we then give our opinion about that particular circumstance and we move directly into suffering. Uh-huh. So one of the things that I say is if you are driven to a particular situation, you want to make a change in the world, that will be a fire in your belly that makes you want to do that. So, for example, the starving children in the Sudan. I can have empathy for that. I can have sympathy for that. I don't expect them to just accept their fate. There are people, though, that have that fire that want to make a difference. And right. that's the difference between wallowing in your misery and being able to make change.
You know, I have to tell you, Dr. Deborah Meal, I've gone through a lot of, how do we say this, catastrophic, miserable events. My late husband died right in front of me in an ER where I knew something was wrong and would later have to change California state law to prove that something was indeed wrong.
Right.
2 years after that, my mother became ill and died in a nursing home. I was hit 2 years ago this month on the street right by my house, and my little dog bled out all over me and died. And people always ask me, Carell, how do you do it? How do you get through this? And I said to them, I wasn't aware that we had a choice to not. You
right.
know, I wasn't aware that there was, I can choose to not get through this. But don't you feel, doctor, and the book again, Joyful Transformation, 22 Keys to Reclaiming Your Authenticity, don't you feel that today in America, a lot of people actually don't feel empowered enough to actually change what is happening?
Right. I think that what happens is that our great grandparents taught a set of skills in regards to distress tolerance, and what you're talking about is resilience. And the interesting thing is that we've gotten out of that culture and we've gotten out of that mindset. So 800,000 people a year commit suicide.
Oh, it's tragic.
And that's a huge number. And so they, as you say, they've decided to check out. So what's going on, and we can ask that hypothetically, but what's going on that makes 800,000 people a year decide that it's not worth it anymore? So what you've experienced, your story, your tragedy, can actually help other people. And if you check out early, then your lessons can't be, again, learned by the next generation. And what a shame is that?
They worried about me after some of these tragedies, and I said,
sure,
I could never kill myself because I'm too curious to I want to know how it all turns out. I mean, I've lived it all.
Me too.
I want to see how it turns out ultimately. Let's talk about acceptance in terms of, how do I say this? There were things until I really accepted Andrew was gone, until I recently accepted that opiates were not a good thing for me, even though I have a back injury, I needed to find a different way to manage that. Until I realized that opiates, you know, until I accepted where I was, I could not draw a map as to where I was going. And I think that's almost in some ways what you're talking about with radical acceptance. We all really need to, what they would say back in the 70s and 80s, is check ourselves.
Right.
And realize where we are at, not where we want to be, not where. Do you know recently a survey came out about obesity? 2/3 of obese people, when asked if they themselves were obese, said no, they were not. They don't see themselves as obese. So I think the first form of radical acceptance needs to really come about being honest about who we are, where we are, both as a person and in society.
Sure. So that prefrontal cortex, that stuff, that gray matter behind your eyebrows, that's your insight, hindsight, and foresight. So if you don't have any insight going on, usually that means that there is something wrong with your thinking process. So what, again, you can learn skills to actually develop that insight. Curiosity is one of those things. But one of those things that, again, having that insight in regards to who you are is part of your authenticity. Uh-huh. For me, it's that authenticity is then what propels you and connects you to the spirit, to the divine of your own understanding, or to the universe if you don't believe in God, which is fine with me.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think that God is the universe, and if there were a God, he or she would encompass the universe. So I really believe there is wonder. I did a whole show about how nowadays we are so quick to jump from thing to thing that we neither absorb the gravity of a lot of these headlines that are flying at us, and maybe it's because each in of itself, each one is horrific, but we also are missing a lot of the wonder because we still live on a wonderful planet. Humans are still wonderful beings, and the universe is a wonderful place. And if you don't take a moment to absorb that wonder, you're missing so much.
Absolutely. That's part of staying in the moment. And that's part of the radical acceptance also.
Dr. Deborah Meal is my guest. We are talking about radical acceptance. And I really like that term because it's odd that you would put the word radical and acceptance together. You know what I'm saying? Like acceptance and fully accepting of who and what you are is a radical concept, you know? But nowadays, I think it is. Do you think, you live in this country, I live in this country, a lot of people sitting around the dinner tables this holiday season. Do you think America really accepts where it is and who it is right now?
I don't. I think there's still a lot of polarization. I think that some of us that are more liberal are still getting used to what's going on. I think there is going to be an amazing shift that happens. And I think that we need to be exactly where we are to be able to launch that next shift in what I believe is going to happen to our society and to our country.
That's interesting because the other day I said to someone, you know, I don't
regret a single thing I've done, because if I had taken one step other than the steps I took, I wouldn't be here. And in spite of all of the tragedy, and in spite of just everything that is my life, I like being me, and I like where I am. I like the people that are in my life and that I love. Of course, I miss those who have gone, but that's just aging. I'm 55 this year, and as you know, as you age, you know, you lose people. Let's wrap up about radical acceptance, because this is a concept that I really think all of us need right now, because it's what's missing. You know, we hear about an opioid epidemic. I maintain there isn't an opioid epidemic. There's an unhappy rat epidemic, which goes back to a study of unhappy rats medicate, happy rats don't. I think a lot of what's going on in our country, the obesity problem, the opiate problem, it all stems from just an unhappiness. And I think that radical acceptance is an idea and a concept that can actually lead you towards happiness. Because once you accept who and what and where you are, no matter what, you can figure out where you want to go next. And we're very lucky in our country. Many of us still have the beauty and the blessing of choices. We can change our own fate. We can make a choice. That in and of itself is a radical concept.
Absolutely. I believe that, again, as we shift our paradigm, we're going to see more and more that that is actually what takes place. That happiness is because when we find out who we are at a gut level and we actually live that instead of living somebody else's life. You know, I always say that God gets tired of us pretending being who we're not.
Right.
Because if the God of our understanding is in everything and in us, then he or she wants to experience it through us. So the interesting thing about that then is that if I'm pretending to be you, God doesn't want me to pretend to be you, because that's, he can't, you know, she can't understand what that's all about. So once we step into who we are at that core level, we experience happiness and bliss that we've never been able to experience before.
And the converse of that, I think we also experience some pain and sorrow, but I also think that's allowable.
Absolutely.
I don't think we have to medicate depression away. I think depression can be a great motivating factor to the next step, which is happiness. Well, thank you so much. When I did hear about radical acceptance and accept your fate, I thought, oh, I must talk to this author. And now I have a great understanding of what it is, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I love how you say the God of your understanding. That is a phrase I am probably going to steal right from you right here, because I think that's a really great way to put it in today's world. Dr. Deborah Meehl, the book is Joyful Transformations, 22 Keys to Reclaiming Your Authenticity. You can get it everywhere, particularly online. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no, it's a joy. I love these types of conversations. Have a happy holiday season. I know they're here. I see the decorations are already up, so have a happy holiday season.
Thank you. You too.
Bye. All right. She was a fun author, a great author, and I really enjoyed our conversation. I really, truly did, because I believe with like her. I loved having a conversation with someone who's a theologian. She's a pastor. And I loved her phrase, the God of your understanding. That's really powerful to me. And I am going to use that. I am going to take that from her, because that's a powerful statement to me. The God of your understanding. To me, that if more people would take that tone, I think we'd be a lot better off in today's world. The God of your understanding. May not be my God. The God of your understanding. All right. We do interact live with our chatters at the chat room. The chat room is located at reallycorrell.com. Anytime that I'm live on the air, which is Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 11:30. During the week, you'll be getting the podcast, but it's done at different times. That's why you can't be live during the week. I've done that to lessen my workload when it comes to the... Plus, I like being a weekend talk show host, by the way. I really do. So I enjoy being with my Patreon subscribers, so please become a Patreon subscriber so you can be with me live, just like Cherokee and Denise and Joe and Jeff and Maxwell and the others who are in the chat room right now at reallycorrell.com watching the video live on Patreon. When we come back, we're going to talk Cannabis Corner, how to make oil and vegan edibles, Plus, is California ready for the sticker shock that's going to happen come January? And if so, or if not, is this going to mean that you're going to start going back to a private underground drug dealer? We're going to talk about cannabis in Cannabis Corner next. Later this week, Mark Summers is going to be here and Michelle Meow. So we got a show, baby. I want you all to know that ever since there's been a Carell cast and now a Carell Life in Segments on TV, Kevin Anderson and PowerMax Computers have, in fact, been a sponsor. And I just, you don't know what it's like to have someone be a sponsor of your little enterprise for 5 years. We've now been dealing with each other. I love these people up at PowerMax. I really, truly do. They're in Oregon. They've just opened a brick and mortar. It is totally a small run company with people all right there that want to serve. You know, these, they got a great sense of humor, too. These are funny people. They have a personal shopper. They have live chat, email, telephone help. You are always connected to PowerMax at PowerMax.com. Now, you can trade up if you've got a used Mac, iPad, iPhone, or iPod. And yes, they still make iPods. And if you've got a used any one of those, you can trade them up, or you can just go there and get brand new. They also have speaker systems. They even have flashlights. Hell, they have everything. They've got, like, monitors. They've got headphones. They've got all kinds of things. More power, more memory, more storage. PowerMax, PowerMax.com at 888-769-7629.
Hey, it's Carell. Not only can you watch me each and every week on Free Speech TV and at lifeinsegments.com, but you can stream me each and every day right here on the Progressive Voices Network, as well as my own dedicated app and all streaming services. Now, here's a little of what you're missing.
It is the Carell cast. I am Carell. So very glad you are joining me on this whirlwind cavalcade of what I call the Carell cast, heard each and every day. Megyn Kelly is a hoe. Let me rephrase. Megyn Kelly is an ignorant... No, Jane, you ignorant... That was Jane. Jane, you ignorant... Yeah, so that's... Okay. We have to think of what Megyn Kelly is. Megyn Kelly was interviewing the cast of Will and Grace on her new Hour of the Today show, right? The whole cast, because they come back tomorrow night. And they had a super fan, someone that loved Will and Grace, and they had flown them out to see the taping and everything. So Megyn Kelly looks at this super fan, who's gay and a lawyer, and says, not making this up, well, Will and Grace might be responsible for a lot of the progressions that we've done in gay rights. And then she looked at this guy and said, do you think that Will and Grace influenced you to be gay and a lawyer? I mean, she said that. Do you think Will and Grace influenced you to be gay and a lawyer? Yeah. And then at the end of the interview, she said, well, it looks like the gay and lawyer thing is going to work out for you. She said that. After the taping, Deborah Messing took to Twitter and said, We did not know that Megyn Kelly was going to be the person interviewing us. We just were told we were doing the Today Show. So we didn't know, did we, Ember? And Deborah Messing said, we wish we hadn't done the Today Show. We wish we hadn't done it. Now, why isn't she fired immediately? To ask someone, did Will and Grace influence you to be gay? I would have looked at her and said, no more than you're influencing me to be a white titled entitled cunt. That's what I would have looked at her and said. But I'm me and not the person that was on television. But that's what I would have said. Sorry. Did it in So why? Why is she working? What inspired me to be gay? Sequins, bugle beads, penises. These are all things that have inspired me to be gay. Mainly the last. But the first are fun too. Sequins, bugle beads, oh yes. And penises. Penises are lovely. I wish I had seen one in the last 2 years that wasn't my own. But I haven't, but I keep hoping. Because they're lovely little things, or big things, medium things, or some are pointy, some go this way, that way, some... I hate the ones that really curve. You never know how to deal with that. I mean, do you go, like, this way, or do you come around this way? Do you have them stand around the corner, and then... I mean, so those, you never really know what to do.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1927. That was the day that the Holland Tunnel, connecting New York City and New Jersey, opened for traffic. Before the tunnel, the only way to cross the Hudson River from the city to New Jersey was by ferry. City officials decided to build a tunnel to alleviate congestion. But they had a problem. All those cars driving underground would cause a potentially deadly buildup of carbon monoxide. There had to be a way to ventilate the tunnel. Engineer Clifford Holland came up with the solution. Big fans located at each end of the tunnel could draw fresh air into the passage. The giant fans were nearly as tall as a 10-story building. In honor of his engineering work, the tunnel was named after Holland. But he did not live to see the completion of his vision. The tunnel also owes its existence to unionized labor. The workers who performed the backbreaking work of digging New York's vehicle and subway tunnels called themselves the Sandhogs. In a 1983 book about the union written by Paul Delaney, a worker recounted his memories of the Holland Project, saying, quote, "The turnover in workers was unbelievable. Men would work an hour or maybe a shift, and they'd never be seen on the job again. Even the strongest men were tired after 15 or 20 minutes in the air. And there was always the worry about being fired. If a man went for more than two sips of water during a shift, he was told to collect his wages and go home." 14 workers died on the project. More than a billion cars have made the trip under the Hudson River since it first opened. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Crowdcast. I am Carell, Charles Raymond Carell Boulay, who just woke up his sleeping dog because it's her nap time, honey. This is Ember's down for the count. All right. Do you know how to make low-calorie pot edibles? Is California trying to create illegal pot activity? Why am I so blurry on the camera? These are all questions that you might be pondering. I want to start with the black market. You know, I think California wants us to go back to our old drug dealers. I really do. I think I have to call Jill on the phone. I remember my old drug dealers. I used to love my old drug dealer. She's fabulous, fabulous, butch lesbian. Oh, my God. Diesel Dyke. I mean, Diesel Dyke. I loved her. I loved Jill. Hi, how you doing? I mean, my God, Jill was more manly than I was. But she sold pot for cheap. $250 an ounce, $125 a half. That made it $60 a quarter and $30 an eighth. That's cheap. Well, California is legalized, and I have been to legal states like Colorado and Washington and fainted, okay? I mean it, fainted. I walked in, and where was I? Washington State. I walked into a dispensary. Four joints, okay, were $80, okay? $80 for four joints. And the guy said that would normally be $30, but there was $50 in taxes. So here in California, come January 1st, when recreational pot becomes legal, the taxes are going to be enormous. And it's going to push the price of pot up by double. So an eighth that's $35 right now is going to be $70. An eighth that's $50 is going to be $100. Well, potheads aren't going to pay that. What we're going to do is we're going to go back underground. So, you know, in the country of Uruguay, which I really want to visit, it was the first Latin American country to have gay marriage and the first Latin American country to legalize marijuana. When the president of Uruguay legalized marijuana, he did something very smart. He set the price of pot. The government grew pot and set the price of that at $1 a gram, which means $28 an ounce, period. And people were like, why are you doing that? And he said, because I don't want a black market in marijuana, you know? And that has stopped a black market in marijuana. So the only way, I think the state should take over growing pot. I do. I really do. Why should our revenue from pot come from the taxation of pot? That's going to make unhappy pot consumers. How about our revenue in the state come from the growing of pot? And we pay growers. We pay people in Humboldt County, where I'm coming soon. Would you all come see me on KGOE land in January or February? I know it's cold in Humboldt then, but would you guys come out of your houses to come and see me? I hope so. I'm going to try to get a gig at Jambalaya or somewhere, probably January, February. So, yes, I agree that we're going to have sticker shock and we're going to end up going back to the black market for marijuana. I really do. I really, truly do. By the way, thank you to Denise and to Cherokee. I do look good. In the chat room at reallycorrell.com, where you can join them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That chat room is operational. I look fan-frickin-tastic. Now I know why people don't look good. It's hard. This morning, Ember and I have walked. My poor little poop dog. She has been with me every step, literally every step of this way. And I have walked my ass off, literally. That's how my ass is leaving me. This morning, we have walked 3.1 miles just on a morning walk. And we've already walked 5 miles. Oh, no, we've walked a total of 4 miles today, 3 miles outside. By the end of the day, we will have walked 6 miles outside and a total of 8 to 10 miles. The orange camera angle that you're referring to on the video live at patreon.com is the Logitech camera, and I'm sorry that it's that way. All right, for those of you that are vegans and you want some pot edibles, let me tell you what to do. Get 2 cups of coconut oil. 2 cups. Okay? 2 cups. Put it in a mason jar. Then take 1/8 of an ounce of your favorite marijuana, 4 grams. Put that, after you grind it up, in the jar. Mix it around with the 2 cups of coconut oil. Put that jar in a crock pot filled with water for 12 hours. Do not let the water into the jar, obviously. And there we have it. You will have your pot edible. I am Carell. Don't forget, reallycarell.com is the website to go to every day to hear the show. And then you subscribe on Patreon. You give $5 a month or more at reallycarell.com, and you get live video every weekend as a bonus. I am Carell. Be who you want to be. So long, doesn't hurt anybody. We'll be back same bat time tomorrow.
You're listening to The Carell Show.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, each Monday and Wednesday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday,
you can hear us 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear. Congressman Ted Lieu, a Democrat from California, is a member of the House Foreign Affairs and House Judiciary Committees. You are one of the lawmakers, along with other veterans, who are urging our own president to halt his heated words with regard to North Korea. Tell us about this, and please tell us why, sir.
We ask the president to stop making provocative statements against North Korea. The reason I did that is because it's very clear we have no good military options against North Korea. When I served on active duty, I was at Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. I was under U.S. Pacific Air Forces. We always did a series of different military exercises, much of it directed against North Korea. And the problem is we can't contain escalation. We don't know how the North Korean regime would react to military force. And if they go berserk and go crazy, a lot of people are going to die, including hundreds of thousands of Americans.
There was a Pentagon report on what a war with that isolated nation would entail. In addition to what you've just said, is there anything else that the Pentagon report found that people listening should be aware of?
Representative Ruben Gallego and I wrote a letter to the Pentagon asking them to explain to the American public what a war would look like. And they gave us a letter that was very blunt. I think their Joint Chiefs were actually trying to send a message. So first thing they said is we would need a ground invasion. That means we can't just launch 59 cruise missiles like we did in Syria and be done with the issue. This would be a long, protracted, bloody war with a lot of ground forces going into North Korea. And we have so little intelligence on the regime that we don't know where all their nuclear weapons are, nor where they are all located. And they also hide them. So we're going to have to try to find those nuclear weapons and secure them or destroy them. And if our ground forces can't do that before they can retaliate, then we're in a lot of trouble because they can detonate a nuclear weapon and kill a lot of Americans and South Koreans.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that briefly, Congressman. We're over here. The people of South Korea are the closest target. And in a sense, anything that is said by this president or any action that we have with North Korea affect one of our strongest allies, especially in that region, South Korea, and the South Korean people themselves.
themselves.
The president of South Korea, President Moon, has repeatedly stated that there will be no military force without the pre-approval of South Korea. So if the U.S. tries to conduct military operations in North Korea and the South Koreans are not with us, that just makes it 10 times harder. And keep in mind, in the First Korean War, China and Russia supported North Korea. So if they were to do that again in a Second Korean War, then there's no reason to believe that the U.S. can even win that war.
Again, that's Mark Levine every Monday and Wednesday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.